up arms, what you lead to actually is a response of censorship or a stronger security state. He's undermining the very causes that he claims to care about.
What do you make of President Trump, the way he attacked Nora O'Donnell? Once again, particularly going after a woman journalist.
Well, it's a pattern of his, which is to attack the press. And this could be a moment a normal president would have said, this was an attack not just on me. This was an attack on our democracy. It was an attack on journalists. And I'm appalled by what's happening. And this is a time to celebrate open, free society. Instead, he takes his personal anger and he can't transcend that. And it's just very, very sad to see to him attacking it. And it's sad to see some people conflating the condemnation of political violence, which should be clear, with criticism. I mean, obviously, you should be able to criticize the president of the United States and say that he did a bad job and he's bad for the country. And that's very, very different than threatening him with violence.
Now, you hear Nora O'Donnell in this when she talks about she's reading from the manifesto and says he's referring to pedophiles and rapists. And when President Trump says, I am not a rapist, I am not a pedophile, she says, oh, because he didn't name Trump. Are you saying he's referring to you? I mean, that was a very interesting moment.
Well, as you know, Thomas Massie and I passed the Epstein Transparency Act to get the Epstein files released. This has been the single biggest issue that has had a blow to the administration. They've been covering up these files. And you can tell it's on the president's mind. He's aware of this. His own wife, the first lady, said, we need justice for Epstein survivors. He still has not, his Justice Department hasn't released the documents. They aren't prosecuting any of the Epstein class, these people who raped and abused these girls. And this is on his mind that he says, no, I have nothing to do with Epstein. But the reality is this was bipartisan legislation. It's the first time Congress has stood up to Donald Trump. And we need to continue to demand the release of these files and these prosecutions.
What do you make of Pam Bondi not coming forward on April 14th? I mean, granted, she was no longer attorney general. And would you say that Trump fired her because he didn't want her to come forward on April 14th? And they would say because she's not AG, she doesn't have to. But they have, isn't it your committee, the House Oversight Committee, has subpoenaed the ex-boyfriend of Ghislaine Maxwell?
Yes. Well, look, I drafted the subpoena with Nancy Mace for Pam Bondi. It was not as attorney general. It was in her personal capacity. So she's in defiance of the subpoena, in violation of the subpoena. She should be held in contempt.
But is she going to be? Who holds her in contempt?
Well, the Oversight Committee has to vote on it, and Congress has to vote on it. And we are working to get the Republican votes, the same people who voted for our subpoena, to say, look, now you need to hold her in contempt. She's not showing up to Congress. You were willing to hold the Clintons in contempt when they didn't come before the committee. They then testified. Why wouldn't you hold Pam Bondi in contempt? She was far more relevant. But she was fired in part because of her mishandling of the Epstein files. There is no issue, not the war in Iran, not prices, that has hurt Donald Trump more with his own base than Epstein. And that is because he ran saying that the government was corrupt, that he was going to expose that corruption. And he has turned out to cover up for the rich and powerful people who wrote laws for their own benefit and abused these young girls. And that has really turned a lot of people who voted for Trump against him. And that's why I believe Bondi was fired. And that's why the administration is reeling on this issue.
So what's going to happen next in the Epstein files case? Again, 3 million files or pages have not been released.
Well, first, King Charles is coming tomorrow. I had requested that he meet with the survivors. He hasn't done that, but the British ambassador assures me that he's going to address it in his remarks to Congress tomorrow.
And explain why you want the king to address it.
Well, his brother is implicated, serious allegations.
Prince Andrew,
of having
the man formerly known as Prince.
Yes. of having abused, allegedly abused young girls, and of course engaged in financial impropriety. There is questions about the royal family's relationship with Epstein. And so I thought he owed it to the survivors to acknowledge them and acknowledge their pain. And if he's not going to meet them, he should very at least address that when he addresses the Congress. But we are continuing to subpoena people, including Bill Gates, including other people who came Howard Lutnick, who went to the island. We're continuing to push for the release, and we're continuing to push for the prosecution of some of these individuals who are in these files, who the survivors tell us raped and abused them as young girls. There have been no prosecutions yet in the United States, though there are prosecutions in many other parts of the world.
President Trump said in that interview with Norah O'Donnell that he was exonerated when referencing pedophilia or rape. Was he exonerated?
He has not been exonerated. If anything, there's been a cover-up. They first did not release the files of someone who made very serious accusations against President Trump. Then they released the files because of journalists' reporting saying they had selectively released files. Now, there is nothing so far that implicates him, but exoneration doesn't mean that there's nothing also that exonerates him. The reality is we still don't have 3 million files, and there are a lot of unanswered questions.
Politico reports members of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee are divided over whether President Trump should pardon Jeffrey Epstein's co-conspirator, convicted co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, in exchange for cooperation in the panel's Epstein investigation. That's according to committee chair James Comer in an interview last week.
That's shocking. And when the survivors testified in front of the Capitol with Thomas Massie and me and Marjorie Taylor Greene, they said that it would be a punch to their gut to pardon Maxwell. She was part of the abuse. You are basically then pardoning someone who committed pedophilia or abetted pedophilia, and you are totally ignoring the survivor's own sentiments. It would be just catastrophic on a human level.
I want to finally ask you, Trump quickly moved to use the incident, the attack on the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to promote the massive new ballroom he's constructing on the White House grounds, posting on Truth Social, this event would never have happened with the military top-secret ballroom currently under construction at the White House. It cannot be built fast enough. If you could address this, I was just watching Eugene Daniels, the former head of the White House Correspondents' Association. He said, we would never hold it at the White House. There is a separation of church and state, meaning between press and the state.
Yes, he still doesn't understand the First Amendment, which is the freedom of the press. Of course, you would not have a gathering of journalists with a comedian who's supposed to make fun of the president, whoever the president is, doing it at the White House, where the White House gets to dictate the agenda. And so there are other reasons we don't need a ballroom, and we don't need corporate donors basically currying favor with Donald Trump, giving millions of dollars to this ballroom pet project of his to get policy. But certainly you would never have this event at the White House. And it just shows that the president still does not get it after all these years about the importance of the freedom of the press.
Finally, the billionaires tax that you and Bernie Sanders are putting forward.
The biggest issue in this country is wealth inequality. We have 19 billionaires who have 12.5% of the economy, $3 trillion. That is three times the concentration of the Gilded Age during Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, J.P. Morgan's times. Bernie and I have said, tax them 5%. That means if you're worth $20 billion, you'll now be worth $19 billion. By the way, their returns are about 10, 15% or more over the last few years. And if we did that, we could have every teacher in this country paid at least $60,000. We could have universal child care. We could have free public college. We could give every working family a $3,000 check. We could expand health care to include dental, vision, hearing. This is necessary for a new social contract in a country that is just seeing wealth inequality explode.
Congressmember Ro Khanna, Democratic representative from California. Coming up, we speak to journalist and professor Jeff Charlotte, author of The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Stay with us.
I'm
musician Kyra Arby, Nightingale of the North, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see all these performances in our studio, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at Saturday's shooting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, we're joined by the journalist and author Jeff Charlotte, professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College, has been tracking the rise of political violence in the United States. His latest book is The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Professor Charlotte, thanks for joining us again. Tell us what you've been tracking since Saturday night.
I've been most interested at the sort of the uses and abuses to which MAGA and other factions of the right have put this narrative, not so much the actual facts of who this shooter Cole Allen is, but the stories they're telling about him and the stories they're telling about Trump and how he responded, and using that as part of the sort of the ongoing project of what you can only describe as a kind of deification of Trump as this man who somehow transcends worldly effects.
Over the past 2 days, President Trump has repeatedly claimed that the suspected shooter was anti-Christian. This is Trump appearing on Fox News Sunday.
The guy is a sick guy. When you read his manifesto, he hates Christians. That's one thing for sure. He hates Christians, a hatred.
Jeff Charlotte, can you respond?
A startling and, on his part, savvy claim. He, of course, had access to what we believe to be, it's not even really a manifesto, it's just a statement of intent by this man, Cole Allen, and was able to characterize it as anti-Christian, which was then picked up across right-wing media and across as well as legacy and mainstream media, declaring this as an anti-Christian attack. So when you come to read the document itself, it's kind of startling to see that, in fact, Cole Allen understood his mission in very explicitly Christian terms, and not just Christian terms, but terms familiar if you've ever read the manifestos of abortion clinic bombers, the idea that you can't turn the other cheek when it comes time to save the lives of the innocent, that the Christian imperative to turn the other cheek doesn't apply if lives are on the line. And he goes further than that. He goes into deeper specificity and a list of sort of five objections that could be made to his awful attack. He offers what are, in his mind, his justifications. And one of them is yield unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And it's a paraphrase of a biblical passage that appears in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The idea of render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's. The Christians are called upon to defer to the authority of the land. Well, he comes with an argument that says, yeah, but that's not so when the leaders of the land are breaking the law, because the land, the Caesar there stands for the law of the land. And since these administration officials are, in his mind, breaking the law, as they are in fact, that he sees this as justification. This is almost the exact same justification used by Vance Bolter, the assassin, the far right, the fascist assassin in Minnesota who killed state legislators. This is much the same rhetoric that you'll find in the old language of the Army of God, the militia that would attack abortion clinics. He's turning it to different ends, but the last thing you can say is this is anti-Christian.
In a Sunday opinion piece in the Sydney Morning Herald headlined, America's Burning with Political Violence, It's a Fire That Trump Keeps Stoking, a former White House staffer, Corey Alpert, writes, quote, political violence has risen sharply over the past decade, more so than at any of the five moments in U.S. history where a sitting president has been shot, leaving four dead and one gravely wounded. Donald Trump has been the leading accelerant of that rise, throwing fuel on the fire at every opportunity. Professor Charlotte, can you respond?
Yeah, I mean, it's indisputable. And it's, in fact, the point that, far rightists and fascists make themselves, pointing to the number of assassination attempts he survived, which is either 3 or 4 or 5, depending on how you count it. And they can debate amongst themselves. But I think what it points us to is we're losing the usefulness of the term political violence. The better term is violence. As you open the show, what do we call this is violence. This was attempted murder, and we can oppose it plainly and simply as that. What do we call the boat strike with which you open the show that was barely reported yesterday? Is that political violence? It's murder. I think what Trumpism has done has given us a spectacle politics that has gotten us far past. We're hearing all these cries. We mustn't normalize political violence. That ship has sailed. It is normal. As evidence, you can see the number of people who are boasting online, well, I didn't really pay attention to this. I was watching something else. I was out being normal. This idea that this is just the humdrum, the boat strike doesn't need to be reported, the shooting in Indiana, as you mentioned, barely reported. It's just the weather. And I think that is the spectacle of Trumpism. And Trump knows that weather is good for fascism. Mm.
And what about this issue of gun violence? You just heard Congressmember Khanna calling for a commission on political violence. Where does the easy availability of guns, whatever shooters' political views are, fit into this story, Jeff?
You know, whatever the number, the latest number is 450 million, maybe 500 million guns in civilian hands in the United States. Guns so readily available, such powerful guns. We know this is true in situations of domestic violence. If there's guns in the house, they're more likely going to be used, and there's going to be murders committed. If there's guns there, someone is going to take whatever logic, whatever grievance they have, and apply a gun to it. A gun, in the sort of the American vernacular, is the cure-all for whatever ails you. I think, again, when you look at the so-called manifesto of this shooter, what's striking about it is that so much of it is fairly conventional. People have been combing over his social media. Nothing really stands out. He was a fan of very many popular liberal and mostly liberal, some left websites. And yet, then there's that moment where he says, okay, but I'm going to add a gun to this. Because I've got a gun. And it, even through the manifesto, you see him following the logic of his own gun. He says, okay, I'm going to try and not harm innocent bystanders or whatever he says. But then at the end, he says, but I will go through anybody. I'll kill anybody to achieve this. Gun in hand, he lets the gun lead him. And it's, I mean, we saw it on video, this man charging like he thinks he's an action hero in a movie with his gun into the ballroom, a fool on a deadly errand.
Very quickly, what is being made of in social media? This alleged shooter saying the man that they now are going to be arraigning today, he was going after Trump administration officials, except for Kash Patel, right, the head of the FBI.
I have no idea what his intention was, but what we're seeing, and I get it, the temptation is to read this as a joke, like he's owning Kash Patel. And, you know, that's as much the normalization of political violence, of gun violence, as I'm thinking of T-shirts and bumper stickers by gun zealots with sexual innuendos around bullets that are too grotesque to say on the air. To make a joke of guns is to diminish any possibility we ever have of reducing their absolute prevalence, everydayness. They are normalized in our lives. So I think that's what's happening. And I think that's Trumpism, even if it's an anti-Trumper saying it. It's the idea that all of this is just entertainment.
Last question. We just have 30 seconds. We're going on to Sister Helen Prejean responding to the Trump administration reinstating firing squad. But the shooting took place at the Washington Hilton. The venue was, of course, the venue of the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan. How does this shooting fit into what you describe as the slow civil war that you believe is occurring in the United States, Jeff?
Yeah, I think the slow civil war is best understood as kind of almost sort of like episodic, in the same way that what played out on Saturday night was, as my colleague Anthea Butler calls it, the story arc of the week in Trumpism, and it will be forgotten by next week. That's why it's important to remember to keep tally of all these violent incidents. And by violent incidents, I don't mean shooters, just shooters like this, although certainly them, but to put them in one long list that includes wars in Iran and Venezuela, all the bombs sent to Gaza, to understand that this, to put them into a conversation with the war on trans folks, all those are part of this slow civil war. This is just one more episode.
Jeff Charlotte, I want to thank you for being with us. Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College's latest book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Coming up, Death by Firing Squad. We will speak to Sister Helen Prejean. Stay with us. First Light by Matthew Alexander Thurtell and Vincenzo Bellomo. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Death by Firing Squad. In its efforts to ramp up and expedite federal executions, the Justice Department announced Friday it's re-implementing lethal injections and authorized the use of firing squads to kill condemn federal prisoners. It's also planning to impose new restrictions on the ability of death row prisoners to seek clemency or pardons, along with a regulation designed to cut years off the federal appeals process for state death penalty cases. Five states already allow execution by firing squad: Idaho, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Utah. At the Vatican, Pope Leo reiterated the Catholic Church's opposition to capital punishment in a pre-recorded video shared with DePaul University to mark the 15th anniversary of Illinois' abolition of the death penalty.
We affirm that the dignity of the person is not lost even after various serious crimes are committed. Furthermore, effective systems of detention can be and have been developed that protect citizens, while at the same time do not completely deprive those who are guilty of the possibility of redemption. This is why Pope Francis and my recent predecessors repeatedly insisted that the common good can be safeguarded and the requirements of justice can be met without recourse to capital punishment. Consequently, the Church teaches that the death penalty is inadmissible because it is an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person.
That video of Pope Leo was sent to DePaul University for a conference on the death penalty. It was Sister Helen Prejean who extended the invitation to the Pope's office for that statement. One of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty advocates and also author of numerous books, including Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty. A graphic edition of the book was published in November. Sister Helen Prejean is joining us from Chicago, where that conference is taking place at DePaul. Welcome to Democracy Now! In these few minutes, Sister Prejean, can you respond to the Trump administration reinstituting death by firing squad?
Firing squad and the electric chair and gas, anything to get executions going, he has now done. I'm not at all surprised that he's done this. when we look at his record and his way of approaching social problems, his first instinct almost always seems to be demonize someone as an enemy and then kill them and destroy them. And the death penalty writ large is Iran, it's Gaza, and it's solving all the problems by using violence. We have to remember that in his first term, Trump, in the last 6 months of his first term, he designated that 13 people were to be executed, and Bill Barr, his attorney general, went in, gave the orders, and they were. I knew some of them and the lawyers who were trying to save their life. But this, when you look at it, it epitomizes trying to solve social problems, all social problems, by designating an enemy and killing the enemy. And you can see that in Trump's rhetoric about political people he considers enemies. He starts going after anybody even who disagrees with him. And he uses violent language about this is treasonous, they ought to be shot. So it's typical of him. But I also see it in the culture of the Deep South, the ex-slave states that are doing all the executions now. I mean, DeSantis in Florida had last year killed 20 people and has already executed 6 and is lining up more to be killed. But it's when you look at the total sweep in the United States, most states, either in law or in practice, are not executing people. It's but the Deep South still is, and they get the rhetoric from Trump. But I see progress being made. But the whole key, Amy, is to educate the citizens. I mean, even juries now in Texas, when they know they have the option of a life sentence or death, are not giving out death sentences. But we look at these pockets, and I see the reason for it, as I understand it, it's the way the Supreme Court set up the death penalty in the Gregg decision of 76, when they allowed huge discretionary power to prosecutors and to executives to carry out death or not. And so these decisions for death are left in the hands of individuals, and Trump being president is one of them. And so they're using violence like there's no tomorrow right now. These are sad, hard times.
Sister Helen Prejean, you have the Trump administration announcing plans to add firing squads, electrocution, and gas asphyxiation to its arsenal of methods to execute federal prisoners on death row. It also noted the obstacles to obtaining drugs for lethal injections. In this last minute, right, what you are calling for now at DePaul in Chicago, where Pope Leo is from.
Yeah. Well, the Pope responded readily to the invitation. We were celebrating the 15th anniversary of Illinois abolishing the death penalty. Governor Pat Quinn, who signed the abolition order into law, was there. So it was to hold up a beacon of light, of hope in the dark times. And so the Pope's very clear. I mean, it was 1,500 years of dialogue in the Catholic Church to reach a position in the catechism of official teaching that no matter how terrible a crime, we can never turn over to governments that absolute power over human life that they can decide to kill their citizens.
Sister Helen Prejean, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Sister Helen Prejean is one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists. She's the author of the best-selling book Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty. That does it for our show. I'll be in Canada tomorrow night at the Hot Docs Film Festival, then in Brookline, Massachusetts, in Washington, D.C., and in Baltimore. Check democracynow.org for Steal the Story, please. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
How much do you love this station? People dedicated to your community. News that directly matters to you. This station needs your support. Go to mycri.ca to find out more about the Community Radio Initiative, which will provide core funding for this station. At MyCRI, you will find an easy way to create an email that you can send to the politicians who need to hear your message. Just 5 minutes and a few clicks make a big difference. MyCRI.ca.